You know, if you treat your employees like responsible, super smart grown-ups, yes, which almost all of them are, but almost all of them are super smart adults. We're afraid of AI, or we don't have our policy built yet, so don't use anything. We have BYO AI, right? Bring your own AI. Like, people are using it whether we want them to or not. We're humans, and, you know, work is work. Let's not, like, over-glorify it, right? Work is work.
Welcome to Future Work, the podcast about a happier future of work and the role of people and technology within that. In today's episode, we explore the idea of treating employees like responsible grown-ups with Amy Leschke-Kahl, a renowned thinker in the people and business space. Her mission is to solve hard problems that you can't see, bust workplace myths, and design solutions for people working in the real world. Before starting her own advisory, Amy served as Vice President of Talent Insights and Innovation for ADP, and she led HRIT, People Analytics, and Learning and Development organizations for several Fortune 500 companies. You'll probably know her for her writing in Fast Company, Forbes, MIT Sloan Management Review, and Fortune. In this conversation, we'll talk about how we should rethink HR structures, embrace AI, and foster a culture of trust and autonomy that can transform organizations. So let's dive in. Hybrid work is here to stay, but are you making the most of it? Join us on July 8th for the Hybrid Work Dilemma. Learn how to do more with less office space while increasing productivity, collaboration, and employee engagement. Hear from Corinne Murray, a Future Work Podcast alumni, and two other experts we'll reveal soon. And this isn't just another webinar. It's a chance to get inspired and connect with peers in a live roundtable to tackle your hybrid work challenges. Thanks to Tectic, the number one rated space logistics platform used by customers like Microsoft, Red Bull, and the United Nations for making this event possible. Sign up now at flexos.org/hybrid2024. flexos.org/hybrid2024. Don't miss out. Amy, thanks so much for being on.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Don.
This is a real honor because I read your article, We Need to Treat People as People and We Need to Grown-upify Work, last year in the midst of like trying to figure out remote work in office. I really love that perspective. I've been begging you to come on and finally you're here. So I'm really happy.
I'm glad that we finally got to make this happen.
This is amazing. So with your rich background, we can go so many directions, but I thought let's start with the most controversial one. Is that okay?
Oh, I love that. Yes.
What is HR's role in the changing world of work? So obviously there are so many massive changes right now, right? I just mentioned remote work. We're now leaning maybe more on hybrid work. There is skills is now a big trend. AI is obviously coming in. What does HR look like now and in the near future?
Well, I think it doesn't look like it needs to look. HR looks very, very much like it has for a long time, since as long as I've been in the workforce, as long as you've been in the workforce. We are still structuring HR, doing a lot of the same programs and processes, maybe with a different font, right? We update things, we change the font or put little curved lines around it and call it, ooh, you know, this is a new approach. But we're very much structured the same way as HR practitioners in almost every organization. You've got someone called maybe the chief people officer or chief human resources officer, whatever you want to call it. But it's interesting because under that CHRO, that top HR job, they have everything having to do with people. And the role of HR, the functions that fit under that are very, very different. And if you think about it, I often think about the analogy of money flowing in and out of an organization. You know, sales sells something, accounts receivable, finance, for example, takes the money in. You may have a different kind of an accounting department. You've got an IT department that's doing all the systems that relate to that. But yet in HR, we smush all of the process, compliance, benefits, oftentimes payroll, sometimes payroll will sit in finance. And then all of the talent-y things also sit underneath HR. So you've got this almost like friction that's created around the same organization having responsibility for compliance, which is super important. A lot of money, right? Payroll tends to be that budget line tends to be the highest in almost every organization. And then you have this talent stuff, which is really a whole different world. So HR continues to be structured with these two things smooshed together. But in the new world of work, particularly, well, I think this has been true for a long time, But especially now, if organizations are going to use their talent to differentiate, which is all they have left.
Yeah.
Technology is great, but as soon as you adopt it, everyone else has adopted it too. It's no longer a big differentiator.
Yeah.
We've kind of squeezed the orange, if you will, to a large degree around process improvement. I have that in my background as well, but we've leaned processes and programs and continuously improved a lot.
Yeah.
So we've kind of in that incremental improvement stage, which is fine. But we're just at this place where we really need to, as leaders, as practitioners, as folks who are committed to amplifying the talent in our organizations to continue to create and sustain differentiated value and contributions to our clients, to our customers, to our boards, to our communities. We've got to think differently about how we do this. It no longer fits the world of work.
Yeah, it seems like that old system doesn't really fit the world today, and then definitely not the world where we're heading to. So what are some changes that we have to make it work?
Well, I don't know if these are the right changes or not, but the way that I think about it is really separating out the operations functions. So things like benefits, payroll, compliance, maybe HR analytics, I don't know. But separating those functions out really clearly from the talent kind of amplification part, the coaching, the learning and development, those things that help organizations and help our employees do more of their own unique best work. That's a totally different mindset. It's different skills.
Yeah.
It's different training. It's a different background. So I think it should be thought of as incredibly separate functions. And do they report to the same person? I don't know, maybe. But I think we have to stop trying to create too much of a Venn diagram about those things.
That's great. So it sounds like we need a lot of change. Now, obviously, the question is always, we're busy enough. We have a lot of work to do. It's very hard to be changing things, especially big systematic changes, while we have all the fires burning. What do we need to do to even get out of that? How do we even get out of the, you know, my day-to-day is too busy to make that change? How do we get out of that?
It takes courageous leaders. I mean, it takes leader who is willing to take a pause in some of the other things and make that switch. And could you experiment with it? Could you try it? Could you pilot it? Maybe depending on the organization. But I think it really needs one of those big, giant, transformative shifts to kind of flip the switch and go, we are going to restructure ourselves in a way that better aligns with our business and better aligns with our employees.
You know, another big change that's obviously coming is what we talked about before, AI, right? And so I totally empathize with a lot of people that I'm speaking to when they say, there's a lot of interesting stuff happening, surely, but it's a bit daunting, it's a bit scary. I think especially in HR, but we can look at this broader than just HR, there's also a lot of questions about, there's the potential, but there's also the threat, right? And I think a lot of people are almost hesitant to start using AI, whether it's in the HR team or outside of it, because they don't even know, am I just automating myself away? Am I starting to create a condition for the company to eventually replace me? So in all those changes that you just talked about, you know, where does AI sit?
I think it's a good question. I mean, I think clearly it will be part of everything that we do in the world of work. And I think it's going to be faster than most people think. And it's already there, even if your organization is saying, you know, we're afraid of AI or we don't have our policy built yet, so don't use anything. We have BYO AI, right? Bring your own AI. Like, people are using it whether we want them to or not. They're using it on their phone. They're using it on their home computer. They're using it all over the place.
Yeah.
So I think that's definitely something for us to think about. But when you think about it from the practitioner perspective, as you just mentioned, we are constantly fighting fires. We have all these things that we're working on. Everybody's coming at us for all kinds of different things. And we need this policy done. And you need to deliver this training. We have this problem employee. We have this one that we want to promote, like all of the things.
Yeah.
So it's hard for the practitioner to find the space to even thought, how might I utilize this? Again, I think there's friction in the system right now, and people are a little bit hesitant. I think naturally so, and they should be. They should be concerned about security. They should be concerned about privacy.
Yeah.
And we also, at the same point in time, need to embrace, how can we create space for people to learn some new skills? You don't have to be about this before we started. You don't have to be an expert in technology to effectively and efficiently use artificial intelligence. How can we use it to help people, number one, automate those tasks that we probably don't need to be doing, quite frankly, but also how can we use it to create space for people to do the unique, extraordinary work that they're capable of doing. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of pluses in doing that, we as leaders and organizations kind of have to open up our mindset a little bit and yet be cautious and reasonable to protect the assets and intellectual property of our organizations.
Yeah. And it sounds like from your perspective, it goes back to, again, this idea of courageous leaders where someone needs to step in and say, we need to make time for this. Like, we need to make room for experimentation. We need to make room for people using this, applying this to their work. Because that's what AI is good at. It's actually good at taking out all this mundane work and all the answering frequently asked questions and doing repetitive workflows and all that stuff. So in order to create that space, someone needs to step up and say, we're now going to make this a priority. And I think we've seen now over the last 6 months, whether it's Klarna on the maybe not so good side, leading all the way to Moderna having this great case study, Microsoft HR globally having these great case studies of, this is really about maybe a little bit of education, but then mostly about just letting people experiment. Because Josh Bersin recently said, no one knows the work like the people who are doing the work, right? Don't try to solve this on a company level. Give people the tools and let them experiment, right? Let them do it. And then if that's on a company platform or on a company account, at least then you have control over where that data goes, because the whole bring your own AI movement is pretty dangerous when it comes to data privacy, data security.
Yeah, absolutely. And it kind of goes back to what we talked again a little bit about earlier about grown-upifying work. You know, if you treat your employees like responsible, super smart grown-ups, yes, which almost all of them are, but almost all of them are super smart adults.
Yeah.
And when you create that partnership with them and say, how might we use this to help your job, to help your work be better, to help make your work more efficient, to give you space to do some of those things that you wish you could do, but you never have time for. Mm. The space for people to go, how can we better serve our customers? Or how can we better serve our internal partners? To me, like, that's the most exciting part of AI. Well, that and really creating the connective tissue. I think we are still in the place. Mm. We have a lot of great point solutions, right? There's a lot of great, you know, I use some of the tools that you just talked about in one of your recent posts about the top 100 AI tools, right? So I go through there and I try lots of them and experiment. But we still have a lot of really good point solutions. But I think when it's going to get really transformative, not that it's not transformative now, but really transformative, is when we can use AI as the true connective tissue in the organization, when essentially point solutions become invisible to us and it's simply us interacting really efficiently. And we have trust in the data that we're getting back. And of course, keeping your data internal and all the security things are super important. So I think we're going to see that, I think, in the next few years. I don't think it's going to take very long, but that's when we're really going to see this be transformative in the world of work. So it's not just a writing assistant. It's not just a chatbot that's going to help my call center employee. It's going to connect everything together into a single system that's easy to interact with.
Yes, and this episode is not brought to you by OpenAI Enterprise or Microsoft, but that's obviously what the vendors would love, right? That you would say, well, you know, instead of everyone using all these little individual tools, just take it for everyone and get, you know, either OpenAI Enterprise or Copilot, or even Gemini is doing it now too. And then, like you said, then the real benefit is there, because it has that connective tissue. It digs from your actual documents and it can reference all the material and all the knowledge in a company. And then it becomes very, very powerful, right? You then also defeat some of the issues around, what are my employees typing into Perplexity AI, or what are they putting into ChatGPT that gets re-uploaded into the model, right? And that's why we saw it really early on, a lot of companies putting bans on using AI, because like a JP Morgan doesn't want their proprietary data or client data to go into the training models. So that may be a next step, but again, that's a lot of work. Companies already have a lot to do. In your conversations, do you see this becoming a larger topic right now? And are companies starting to realize that this actually is the important thing that we knew it was?
Yeah, they are. And I'm starting to see, at least I was just at a conference today of a bunch of executive learning leaders from the Midwest. About 100 of us all got together today and talked primarily about change, but a lot of it centered around AI. And particularly in that learning space, it's number one, it's really good, fertile ground for making things more efficient, but also for the ability to personalize and conditionalize, right? It's not just about, we talk about personalization in quotation marks, whatever, you know, kind of sort of personalization. But when you think about the ability, for example, in the learning and development world to have much more real time in the flow of work, not an extra thing, but in, I mean, the possibilities are amazing. If you're sitting here talking to a colleague and you have a little, you know, a little pop-up or a little nudge that comes and says, hey, you might want to ask Don this question.
Yeah.
Because I know that this happened to him yesterday and he was experiencing work in this way. Mm-hmm. And I know how he tends to like to be communicated with and he doesn't like this. I don't need to know all of that. I don't need to know any of it. All I need to know is a little pop-up that says, hey, you might want to ask Don this question when you talk to him in 5 minutes.
And that's where the idea of the co-pilot, the co-intelligence comes in. It's not really about like replacing. It's about augmenting. It's about, you know, you may not have that perfect memory, but the AI does, and therefore it can serve up that question.
Well, and hopefully it's smarter. When we think about the relationships and the connections that we have as humans, a lot of people assume, people are always talking about empathy, right? Oh, we should have empathy. I'm not that. That's not me. Like, I'm not a verbally empathetic person. I don't think you can teach it to me. You can make me more aware. But when the chips are down, I am who I am. But AI can help me with that and remind me by little nudges. It doesn't have to like to, I'm going to get this nudge and you should ask this question because of these 27 things. I don't really care.
Yeah.
But it can help me to dig deeper, to be more responsive, to be more respectful, quite frankly, sometimes. All of those things. And I think that's where, especially on the talent side of things, where the possibilities, and obviously organizations are doing some of this and some are doing lots of it already. There's a whole lot of potential on that side of the world of work. Yes, process efficiencies, and that's great. And knowledge mining, that's great too. But I also think there's an amazing amount of potential on helping us to be better coworkers, helping us be better peers, helping quite frankly, be more reasonable human beings.
Human beings. Yeah, exactly. And did you see, you mentioned that you were at that conference, did you see any interesting solutions, particularly to solve some of those challenges?
We didn't really look at any point solutions. It was a little bit more conceptual, but there were a couple of companies there who were talking about what's possible. Again, kind of that, obviously, personalization, which happens to some degree now. But the ability to not only personalize, but to look at the conditions that are happening. And of course, that requires data in order to inform the model, right, about what is happening. And I think one of the very interesting things I see happening in the world, particularly, again, of talent, is a lot of our data is so old. It's not real time.
Yeah.
We might look at someone's, you know, career profile they put in 18 months ago. Or we may look at a performance rating, which is a whole different conversation and a whole different hot mess. But you may look at somebody's performance rating from even 9 months ago, or you might look at a piece of engagement data that's been aggregated over a team or an organization. And that's not super helpful.
Yeah.
Because work is moving too fast for that data to be used. We need to have the critical few pieces of real-time data informing these models to be able to help me in the flow of my work right now, not based on data that collected 9 months ago, but based on data that's happening right now. And that's totally possible. We just have to connect all those dots together.
Incredible. As you're talking, it's just incredible how different this world of work really is from even just 5 or 10 years ago, right? And the culture that this requires to work in this way, where we even acknowledge something like data from 9 months ago isn't valid anymore. Whatever we were talking about, my performance 9 months ago, has nothing to do with where we stand today. How do companies optimize their culture for how fast things are moving?
Yeah, I mean, and that's not an AI thing. That's a people thing. That's a leader thing. And by leader, I don't necessarily mean like manager person. I mean like an executive leader who sets that tone. I think oftentimes when we talk about culture, we say, and you've kind of, I know you've looked at this article that I wrote for the MIT Sloan Management Review around culture, right? I talk about little C culture versus big C culture.
Yeah, yeah, love that.
And that big C culture being those promises that we make to our employees. And we oftentimes think about culture as we do a survey, we want to know how people experience work. I'm like, no. I mean, that's fine, by the way. But that's not what I'm talking. I'm talking about the promises that the organization is making to their employees that they never, ever break. Like, I can count on these critical few things. Like, what are those things for your organization? And so I think when we look at culture and what are those critical few things, that's a human thing. That's a leader determination thing. It's not a, we let everybody else make it up. This is a, us as a leadership team, as an executive team, are promising to you as an employee that this XYZ thing is going to happen every single time. There's no exceptions. And you don't need 100 of them. You need 3 or 4 of those things. Mm. So when it comes to like AI and culture and all the things, that big C culture, that's a leader determination. Leaders get to pick that because that's what they get to do. And they shouldn't shirk that responsibility, by the way.
No, not at all. But do you see companies getting better at that, or is it getting more difficult to do that?
No. I don't think it's difficult to do it. I think they just don't do it. Leaders, well, it's hard. You don't want to make that promise because then, you know, you might break it. Like, I don't want to really say that because what if we, you know, there's always an exception. Like, we're going to do this except particular situation, or it applies to these people, but not to these employees. So it's not hard. It's just a choice that, you know, organizations have a lot of choices to make. And it's just it's one of the choices they need to make. But most organizations never make the choice. They kind of go with the standard, right? You know, oh, we have a culture of integrity, or we have a culture of diversity, or a culture of whatever. I'm like, really? No, there's always exceptions to that. There can be no exceptions to big C culture.
Yeah. But it sounds like something that companies are almost in a bind, where the way that a company is being run already doesn't allow them to say that our word is our bond. We will practice with integrity, because they already know there's a bunch of stuff going on that would not pass muster. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Going back to that theme of like grown-upify work, right? Which again, I think that was in the context, I think, more about like hybrid work and remote work, and saying, you know, why are we even worrying that much about productivity, or, you know, whether people are performing or not performing? I think, again, like in contrast to what we just talked about, it's not like the execs are doing so well, right? It's not like they are the ultimate role model of showing up 5 days a week in an office and being super productive, right? Because, you know, they also have their own way of working. Where is that debate settling? Obviously, you're based in the US, where that I think it's still a pretty hot topic of where should people work and how should people work and how often and how much control should we have over that? Where is that debate settling in your mind?
Where it's settling is so many organizations are requiring employees to come back to the office. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've got real estate organizations that have invested in real estate and buildings, et cetera. And there's still the old mindset that we cannot work together unless we see each other. We can't be collaborative. We can't be sharing. We can't be innovative unless we are sitting face to face. And I think that is just, for most of us, false. For some people, that is where they work best. But for a lot of us, the only thing that's missing in making that happen is intentionality. You know, we think about the water cooler, you know, the kind of the euphemism of the water cooler. I'm going to meet you at the water cooler and we're going to come up with the next great idea. And maybe, but there's no reason why you and I cannot schedule a water cooler talk. Or there's no reason why I can't contact you on Zoom or WebEx or Microsoft Teams or whatever, or Slack, and ping you and say, hey, you have 5 minutes. I'd love to run this by you. It's, again, part of that needing to integrate that communication and partnering into the flow of our work. It's we just need to do it. It's totally possible. And in a lot of cases, for a lot of people, it's much more productive. It's much more creative. It's much more innovative. Because a lot of times we are more innovative when there's one or two of us, and then when there's 20 of us in a room with a whiteboard and we all end up with the same answer that we knew we were going to end up with when we walked into the room. So it's just intention, and it's part of the rhythm of work that we need to add in. And we all did that during COVID. That's the interesting thing about it. It's like we figured it out for 2 to 2.5 years, whatever it was, 3 years.
Yes.
We all figured it out, and it was amazing. We got great work done. Yeah. It's not like things stopped happening. In fact, work happened faster.
Faster, yeah.
More innovatively. And we all felt trusted.
Yeah.
As employees, we felt incredibly trusted and enabled and empowered. That's such an overused word. But we kind of felt empowered to own our own world. And all of a sudden, it's like, oh, no, we don't trust you anymore. And that's kind of what it feels like to the employee. It might not feel that way to the executives making those decisions. And they have their reasons, and that they need to do what they need to do, what they think is right. But from an everyday employee perspective, there are so many folks that I talk to every day that feel like, wait a minute, you don't trust me anymore? You trusted me just fine for 2 years when all the chips were down and we had to figure out how to do stuff on the fly. But now you don't trust me anymore? So I think there's friction again between a lot of everyday employees and a lot of executives. And, you know, it goes back to choice in a lot of ways of what are the he's going to choose. And I wonder when we get the data back and we kind of start to look at this longer term, what the longer term implications are to employee engagement, to employee satisfaction, to employee productivity, people having to get up and get ready and get in the car and drive to work and or commute or get on the train or the bus. And you know, that's a lot of time and energy. And as we talk about things still like well-being and wellness, not as much as we did a couple of years ago, but there's, again, friction between those two things is, oh, we want, you know, we're committed to your well-being, but we also want you to sit in traffic for 2 hours a day and make you late, you know, if you're late to pick up your kid from school or whatever that might be. So I don't think we've landed yet.
But then again, if you don't sit in traffic for 2 hours to come to the office, then where would you do your Zoom calls, right? So like, I think we hear that a lot, people saying, okay, I made that effort, I made that investment, and then I just end up sitting mostly just on Zoom calls, because for most companies, the reality is that we're not working together in one space anyway. We have people in other offices, in other locations. We work with clients. We work with outside partners. Our executives are all over the world, right? It's not like we come there and actually constantly sit with our team. Gensler just released some research around that. So it doesn't really make sense in a way. And then there are great examples like an NVIDIA or an Atlassian or a Dropbox, where then people would typically say, yeah, but those are tech companies. Of course, the techies can do it, right? Of course, NVIDIA can build a $2 trillion company on the back of a remote policy. What would you say to those companies? Because it sounds like you say, this is really not about tech or non-tech. Anyone can basically apply these principles.
Well, it's about the work. I mean, so, you know, when you talk about remote work, it's really about the work. And that's, I think, another one of the mistakes that organizations have made if we've transitioned out of the COVID era, which is they've made it about the person, not about the work. If the work required to be on site, you know, you think about retail or healthcare, for example. But even if the organization's determination is that this work needs to be on site, then it needs to be on site. And you as an employee, you know that. That's for sure.
Yeah.
But a lot of organizations have gotten into the practice again of exception giving. And what about this person? And this person's not coming in. It's like, it's not about the person. It's about the work.
Yeah.
That's a game changer, is you got to keep it about the work and remove the, because if you think it, if it's about the person now, it's, I take it personally. And how come that person get to work from home and I don't? Like, no, all our customer service reps are going to be in the office. That's probably not the right call to make, but maybe it is. But just make that call. This is how we do our work.
Yes, I love that idea. It's about the work, not about the person. And we're maybe focusing a bit too much on, you know, the mistrust and like, yeah, I don't see that person that much. What are they doing? What are they up to? Doesn't really matter, right? If the work gets done, the work gets done. So why do we even care? And then the other thing is that we are now seeing a lot more people trying to build a portfolio of work, trying to focus less on having just that one job, right? So even then, you were going to get a lot more of a fragmented point of view. How are you looking at leadership, right? Because obviously you talk mostly to the really senior leadership. Does leadership need to change, or does leadership development change as the world of work is changing so fast? I feel like even from this conversation, I just feel like there are so many changes and they're happening so fast. How do you even train someone to become, you know, the next C-level leader?
Well, I think we have to think about leading in lots of different ways, right? There are people leaders, are knowledge leaders who may not lead people at all. Teams are changing. There's dynamic teams. I'm working with an organization right now that is very much committed to and transitioning a lot more of their teams to a dynamic team model where you've got someone who leads a team for a short period of time, a sprint, not necessarily in technology. We think about it as a tech programmer thing, but it can happen in lots of different ways. So I think when we think about leading, we often over-engineer the world of leading. We have this assumption that there's some perfect model out there that we all ought to fit into. There is no such thing. Most of us don't want to be people leaders. We want to make more money and get a better job title and better support ourselves and our family, which absolutely we want that.
Yeah, yeah. Why does that have to come with managing?
help me. No, but that's just part of the job. It comes with it. And so part of the reason why people don't want to be people leaders is we've made it a horrible job. So one of the keys to creating an organization that has, I'm going to say, good leaders is to focus on the critical few things. Like, what are the critical few things you need that leader to do to be proficient? I need you to connect with your people or your peers or whoever it is. I need you to have really connections, because we know from the data that that is a game changer. Not give feedback, just connect with people about the work. Because I can talk to you about the work all day long. But as soon as I know that I have to talk to you about you and your, you know, soft, touchy-feely stuff, that's not happening. So if you keep it focused on the work and those critical few things, it becomes a much more reasonable role for people to play, is to lead the work. Mm. And when we people like grownups, drama tends to diminish. It's always still going to be there, but we tend to have less drama, less conflict. You're super smart. I trust you to go be super smart. And that the whole vibe, or if you want to call it kind of little C culture of teams, but that whole vibe starts to change. It just feels different. It feels like we're all really smart. Like, how fun is it to work around really smart people?
Yes.
It's really fun.
And just splitting the emotion from the information. And again, just focusing on the work. So it sounds like there are opportunities to make the world of work better, and it sounds like there's still a lot of work to do as well. If we could summarize it in one wish for the future of work, what would it be from your side, personal?
Yeah, it would be to start treating people more like grownups and less like seventh graders. When we think about when we hire people into our organizations, we bring them in for all those unique pieces of intelligence and commitment and quality, like all the things, no matter where they are in the hierarchy. Right, we bring them in because they've got a lot of opportunity to contribute to our clients, our customers, our organization, our colleagues. And yet, once they're in the door, we kind of don't treat them that way.
Yeah.
And I think we are missing an incredible amount of opportunity inside of organizations to, again, differentiate the work that we do, our companies, and we're humans, and you know, work is work. Let's not like over glorify it, right? Work is work.
Yeah.
And we need to get paid. We need to support ourselves and our families. But I think if we can help people walk out that door, virtual or physical, a little bit better, feeling a little bit better, maybe a little bit happier, the ramifications of that are game-changing, not just for our workplaces, but for our employees' families, for the communities in which we work. And we're not quite doing that real well. And I think that's where so much of the opportunity lies, is just to treat our employees like the super smart grown-ups that they are.
See people like grown-ups and focus on the work, not the people. I love it. Amy, thanks so much for being on today.
Thanks so much for having me, Don.
Thanks so much for joining us today as we explore the transformative power of treating people like grown-ups with Amy Leske-Kahl, the renowned people and business advisor and writer. Today's discussion unveiled several critical insights into modernizing HR and workplace culture. Number one, treat employees like adults. Amy passionately argued for treating employees like responsible adults. If you treat your employees like responsible, super smart grown-ups, they will thrive, she said. So, foster a culture of trust and autonomy, empowering employees to take ownership of their work and make meaningful contributions. Number two, separate HR functions. Amy emphasized the need to separate operational functions from talent amplification in HR. Distinctly separating compliance and payroll from coaching and development functions can streamline operations and enhance focus. Consider reorganizing HR departments to delineate between operational and talent functions, ensuring each gets the attention it deserves. And number three, embrace AI for connection. Amy highlighted how AI can help us be better coworkers, which highlights that AI is not just for automating tasks. It can enhance human interactions and relationships at work. Implement AI tools that facilitate better employee communication and understanding, using data-driven insights to foster stronger workplace connections. And number four, courageous leadership for transformation. Amy discussed the importance of leaders willing to make bold changes, saying, "It takes courageous leaders willing to take a pause and make that switch. Significant organizational change requires leaders who are brave enough to disrupt the status quo. Pilot innovative structures and processes, creating a culture that supports experimentation and growth." And the final one, focus on the work, not the person. Amy pointed out that focusing on work rather than on personal traits reduces unnecessary friction. Emphasizing work outcomes over personal characteristics can create a more objective and fair environment. Develop performance metrics and feedback systems, concentrating on work quality and outcomes, minimizing personal biases. Join me again next week when I interview Amber Warner, the founder of Vet, a fascinating platform that uses AI to match interviewees with human recruiters, even if it's 1 a.m. Subscribe for updates at flexos.org/futurework.